Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, which happens to be, I think, the occasion of the 200 years since Jane Austen died. The Australian Today quite appropriately ran an obituary. They said it was a couple of centuries late, but it was worth doing. And we think it's well worth having Wal Walker here tonight, and the topic is Jane Austen and Darcy Wentworth, Facts and Fiction. Now, Wal Walker is the author of two volumes called Jane and Darcy. The first one, Folly is Not Always Folly, which has been out for a little time, and the second one is about to be launched by the former Governor of New South Wales, Maria Bashir, later this month, called Such Talent and Such Success. So Wal Walker's going to talk about both these books with reference to the theme, and we have copies of, Janet Grundy's got copies of the book available after. Now, I'll introduce our speaker briefly. He was educated at Gatton College in Queensland, at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, where he did an economics degree. He's worked in the aluminium industry. He worked as an accountant. He spent some time in Israel. He worked in Britain. He worked back in Australia with Total in the oil and related industries. But I guess the principal reason he's got this interest is that for the topic Jane Austen and Darcy Wentworth, as our speaker is, I think this is right, his grandfather was Darcy Wentworth's great-grandfather. Is that the right way around? Or was the other way around? Well, you know what I mean, you know. Okay. All right, so let's go with Wal Walker on Jane Austen and Darcy Wentworth. You may explain the relationship as we start. Here we go. Thanks.
Well, thank you, Gerard. Today is the 200th anniversary of Jane Austen's death in Winchester in 1817. The Sydney Institute has kindly invited me to speak on the topic, Jane and Darcy, Fact or Fiction. In Jane and Darcy, I write about events that occurred in Jane Austen's youth. It is a story of Jane and Austen and Darcy Wentworth, their youthful romance and adventures, the heartbreak of their separation, and the impact on the rest of their lives. David Marr has said that the most important aspect of writing a biography is to ensure that you catch the real person. Jane and Darcy is a biography of two people. I believe I have dismantled many of the fictions woven around each of them over time, revealed long hidden facts, and captured two real people. I have told the story from a Wentworth family perspective. My uncle Bill Wentworth asked me in 2002 to write it. I'd never read Jane Austen. I had only a broad general knowledge of the period. I came at the story looking for the facts, but perhaps the most difficult task was sorting them out from the fictions about Jane Austen that have persisted unquestioned for 200 years. Jane Austen enthusiasts know her only from her later life, from her selected letters and her novels published in her late 30s and early 40s. Her youth is unknown to them. It was hidden away from public view. Her family suppressed any information about her teenage years, and that suppression has been maintained for over two centuries. In Jane's own writing from this time, she presented herself as a vital, exuberant and adventurous. Jane Austen was born on the 16th of December 1775 at Steventon in Hampshire, where her father, the Reverend George Austen, was the rector and ran a boarding school for teenage boys, preparing them for university entry. She was the seventh of eight children. She had five older brothers, an elder sister, and who was almost three, a younger brother born 3.5 years later. In her youth, Jane Austen felt a great insecurity. While still a babe in arms, she was sent from home to live with a neighbouring dairy farmer and his wife. The wife breastfed her, and Jane lived with them until she was old enough to run about and talk. She was almost four when her second eldest brother, George, was sent away to the care of a distant neighbour, unwanted because of his disability. When she was seven, her third eldest brother, Edward, was sent away to Kent to live with wealthy, childless relatives to become their son and heir. At seven, Jane was sent to boarding school near Oxford with her older sister, Cassandra, and a cousin, Jane Cooper. The school relocated to Southampton, where Jane nearly died of typhus fever. At 10, she and Cassandra were sent to another boarding school in Reading, making room for their father to enrol more boarders in his school in the Steventon Rectory. It occurred to Jane she may have been found in a haystack by the Austens and adopted by them. Her insecurity may have predisposed her to a restless, rebellious and romantic youth. She was encouraged by her sister Cassandra and cousin Eliza de Fury. She wrote stories about her youth and plays, and they were recorded a great deal about her romance and adventures with Darcy Wentworth. Darcy was a tall, handsome Irish surgeon who'd come to London to gain accreditation from the company of surgeons that would give him employment in the East India Company. During this time, while waiting an appointment, he attended lectures and walked the wards at St Bartholomew's Hospital to gain further practical experience. In the evening, to support himself, he played cards for money. As a cousin, friend and protégé of Lord Fitzwilliam, he had entree into London society and to the up-and-coming young society gamblers. He was often disillusioned by their failures to pay their losses. He even held up some of them to recover these debts. It was a dangerous method of debt collection. It put him in a category of highwaymen. Several disgruntled gambling colleagues took him to court, principally to name and shame him. As prosecutors, they did not want to be outed themselves as defaulters on gambling debts, and would abandon their cases by failing to appear, to recall events, or to recognise him. Darcy was arrested and sent to Newgate, awaiting trial in the Old Bailey. He found himself a celebrity in the court and a popular villain in the press. At first, the Austens were thrilled with Jane's attachment to somebody who was so well connected. When they learnt of Darcy's notoriety, they became very anxious about their teenage daughter's involvement with him and dissuaded him from travelling to dissuaded her from travelling to Botany Bay as his wife. It is understandable that the Austens closed ranks to protect Jane from criticism and to salvage the good name of the family. It is understandable they were hostile to her marriage to a notorious highwayman, that they prevailed on Jane to abandon him, that their relationship and his name were never to be mentioned again. 2 weeks after they parted, Darcy left England for New South Wales. His departure was timely for the Austen family. Their secrecy was reinforced by his disappearance and his silence. The day before Darcy sailed, Jane's brother Henry wrote in the Loiterer, reflecting his family's sentiment, when he applauded the world for getting rid of all surplus inhabitants, all those who have too much cunning and too little money, shipped off with the very first cargo of convicts to Botany Bay. From this time until the end of her life, Jane remained confined within the family circle. She resented the persuasion of her family. Under pressure, she had rejected Darcy, but she never stopped loving him. She hoped and she wished and waited like the heroic Penelope for his return. For both, it was a heartbreaking decision. Darcy remained the fixed star in her firmament and the love of her life. Like a Homeric Greek tragedy, it was sad and lamentable. Darcy sailed on the Second Fleet aboard the Neptune, the worst of the three slave ships used in that convoy. He was the first paying passenger to arrive in the colony, and though not appointed from London, he found work immediately as a surgeon. He served in Sydney, on Norfolk Island, at Parramatta. His patients were mainly convicts, paupers and emancipists, those convicts who had served their time or received pardons. He served under seven government governors and worked closely with most of them. But it was with Macquarie he found immediate rapport. Governor Macquarie came ashore in Sydney on New Year's Day 1810. After the debacle of the Rum Rebellion, he knew he would need able and reliable men to support him. He recognised Darcy as enlightened and intelligent, someone he could trust. He knew instinctively he had found the right person to help him to realise his vision for a better society for the colony. Both men were over 6 feet tall. They were the same age, 47, born a fortnight apart. From the outset, Macquarie placed new and heavy responsibilities on Darcy's shoulders. Within 8 months, Macquarie had appointed him principal surgeon of the colony, treasurer of the colonial fund, chief magistrate and superintendent of police, justice of the peace, a member of the court of civil jurisdiction, and a commissioner of the first major building project, a turnpike road to be made forthwith between the town of Sydney and the Hawkesbury. Later in that year, Darcy was invited to join the members of the winning tender to build the Rum Hospital in Sydney, to contribute his knowledge and experience in the design and construction. Darcy was Macquarie's great assistant, and he rose to each new challenge. In the years that followed, he took on other demanding and ambitious projects. He was a founding director of the colony's first bank, the Bank of New South Wales, and later its president. When Macquarie established a native institution for the education of Indigenous children at Parramatta, he appointed Darcy to the Committee of Management. An army of historians, biographers and critics have laboured for nearly 200 years over the story of Jane Austen and the sources and significance of her writing. They were aware that the family had destroyed most of her letters and suppressed her early writings, and that for more than 50 years, though often asked, the family members had refused to provide any information about her. In 1869, 52 years after Jane Austen's death, her nephew, James Edward Austen Leigh, finally gave way to the growing public interest in her and published his memoir of Jane Austen. He said very little about her youth, though he admitted that the family had refused to release her early stories. He described them as ridiculing the improbable events and the exaggerated sentiments which he had met with in sundry silly romances. He summed up Jane's life as singularly barren, few changes, and no great crisis ever broke the smooth current of its course, and there was no definite tale of love to relate. Most, if not all, her readers simply didn't believe him. But despite their unreliability, for 150 years, the Jane Austen critics and biographers have reiterated these fictions. They have left hidden the secrets her family did not want revealed. A few raised questions about the fictions around her life, but never seriously explored them. They turned a blind eye to clear and obvious references in Jane Austen's writings that contradicted her family claims and might have directed their research to reveal something of her secrets. We know there was difficulties put in their way. Virginia Woolf declared nearly 100 years ago, anybody who has the temerity to write about Jane Austen is aware that there are 25 elderly gentlemen living in the neighbourhood of London who resent any slight upon her genius as if it were an insult to the chastity of their aunt. I can add that there is a much larger contingent to take on today than the 25 elderly gentlemen. Today there are hundreds of university departments, students, professional Janeites and groups of enthusiasts who talk and read and write about Jane Austen. It is a cohort that prefers to regurgitate fictions, not to look for facts. To quote Professor Peter Washington, who edited the Everyman's volume on Jane Austen's juvenilia, they suffer from a literary form of heritage syndrome, or HS. What really turns them on is historical recreation, and they rejoice in their rigor mortis. I've endeavoured to reveal the Jane portrayed by her own writings, not the fictional myths promoted by her family and maintained for the last 200 years. In my search for facts, not fiction, I followed lines of inquiry that seemed to me to be fairly obvious. If there was nothing to hide, why, soon after she died, did the family destroy most of Jane's correspondence? Why did her sister Cassandra take up her scissors and cut certain references from the letters from Jane that she kept? The first of Jane Austen's remaining letters date from January 1796. Covers the arrival of Tom Lefroy at Ashe. Was this a deliberate ploy by the next generation of her family? Even though Jane says in this letter, "I do not care sixpence for Tom Lefroy," Jane Austen and aficionados claim he was her real love. He came into her life 6 years after Darcy's departure and well after the completion of her most significant juvenilia stories. None of Jane's letters remain from 1801 to late 1804. There are only three between August 1805 and mid-1808, and no letters left from June 1811 to November 1812, or from November 1813 to March 1814. These were all periods in her relationship with Darcy, important periods. Her biographer, David Noakes, commented that in this period, tracing the life of Jane Austen is like searching for a missing person. Did the Austen family suppress her early stories, the three volumes of the Juvenilia, because many of them related directly to the period and the events of her romance with Darcy? From these early writings, it's quite clear that Jane's chronological age did not reflect her maturity, knowledge, or intellectual development. One can understand why it would have been difficult to impede her great desire to discover the wide and exciting world that lay beyond the rectory at Stephenson and what it might offer. From the age of 13, Jane read her stories aloud after dinner for her family amusement. Many of them dealt with the young girl finding a way to adulthood, with love, sex, and marriage, with schemes to defeat the wishes of despotic parents, of youths hurrying off to Scotland. At age 15, Jane wrote of visiting Newgate and appearing in court. At 16, she declared she had married without the consent or knowledge of her father. Her Juvenilia was not released for publication until more than 100 years after her death. The second volume was released first in 1922. The first volume was published in 1933, and the third volume was not released until 1951, 134 years after Jane's death. In one of these stories, Leslie Castle, she recorded a visit to Scotland and described her impressions in detail. Years later, in a letter to Cassandra, Jane recalled that a coach trip had put me in mind of my own coach between Edinburgh and Stirling. In 1913... two of her great nephews added a footnote to the letter, protesting, "A visit of Jane to Scotland, of which no record is left in family tradition, is so improbable that we must imagine her to be referring to some joke or possibly some forgotten tale of her own." The Austens knew that to admit a young girl had travelled to Scotland could only mean one thing. She had gone to take advantage of Scottish law, which, unlike the English Marriage Act of 1753, permitted youths to marry without parental consent. It was common practice for young couples to travel to Gretna Green, just across the Scottish border, for a Scottish marriage, and several of Jane's cousins and nephews did so. Jane's writing from her earliest times are filled with stories of elopements and marriages performed under Scottish law. A few of the Jane Austen biographers, like David Noakes and John Halperin, have tried to find the missing facts. Halperin commented on the unsubtle ritual closing of ranks among the family and felt it helped explain why so many have laboured so long to discover what was hidden. Surely something was hidden. Could this life, could any life be so devoid of events, of crises, of attachment? And what about all that burning and pruning of the letters carried out so assiduously by Cassandra? The effect of the destruction was to suppress anything of a particular intimacy. As one critic surmised, the gaps in the letters can be expected to correspond with crises in their author's life. But she was not supposed to have had any crises. Reading and critical discussion of Jane Austen's writing is limited mainly to her 6 published novels, an area studied well, entrenched before the release of A Juvenilia. Many of these early stories and plays relate directly to Darcy and their adventures together. But there has been little attempt by professional Austen critics and biographers to understand the zany stories or black humour of her Juvenilia, their significance or their meaning. The Austen family, in protecting her name, claimed she'd never left Steventon. But the fact is that it was only after Darcy left England that she became totally corralled within the family circle. Most fiction writers rely heavily on their own life experiences to provide material for their stories they wish to create. Jane was no different. She was a truth teller. She was the daughter of the parson, and she wanted desperately to record her most important feelings and experiences. Those her father had ruled were never to be discussed. Throughout all her stories, she reveals to the reader shards from her own early life. It was a very short period in her youth that she spent as friend and lover of Darcy. This period provided her with the emotional experience and knowledge of the world that she would reveal through her writing. In her maturity, Jane was more circumspect than she had been in her teens, but she described her emotional experiences. She named people and included many characters from this time. For these revelations, she faced anger and criticism from her brothers. The Austen family, from the time Jane returned home, wanted her history hidden from the world. The family promoted the fiction taken up as a fundamental truth that Jane never went to London other than the one time that she, on her return from visiting her great uncle Francis in Kent. But we know from her Juvenilia that by the age of 14, Jane knew the layout of London, the social stratification of the streets and squares. It was not possible to have written Sense and Sensibility, in which she drew so precisely on that knowledge, without ever having spent time in London. Sense and Sensibility, her first novel, she drew a vivid picture of Marianne's grief, angst and total breakdown at the end of her great love affair. It is extraordinary that anybody reading that novel could accept the Austen fiction that Jane had no experience of love. It is not hard to believe she was writing her own experience. How might a biographer of Jane Austen have unravelled the secrets of her romance with Darcy without the benefit I had of access to a long-held family story? I suggest they might have followed up specific facts in her stories, put together her references to real people and families, particularly the Wentworths and Fitzwilliams. In her writing, Jane made reference to members of both these families and used many of the family names. Darcy and Lord Fitzwilliam were cousins and loyal friends. In Pride and Prejudice, Jane gave a cameo role to Colonel Fitzwilliam, the younger son of a lord and a cousin of Mr. Darcy. another important character in the novels, Wickham, was a real person. In 1813, in her letters, Jane refers anxiously to the real Wickham, who has returned to Hampshire, near to where she was living. Inexplicably, none of her critics or biographers have veered from the Austen family fictions to follow up the clues that Jane writ large in Pride and Prejudice, which could have led them to the true story of her romance with Darcy Meadow. Following her elopement to Scotland, Jane held to a marriage to Darcy, notwithstanding that her father had refused to give his permission or to marry them formally under English law in St. Nicholas in Steventon. Neither Jane nor Darcy ever entered into a second marriage. Jane was proud and happy to be part of the Wentworth-Fitzwilliam clan. In one of her few letters that slipped through her family censorship, after her sister Cassandra and her niece Fanny Knight referred to her as Miss Darcy, Jane replied to them as Mrs. Darcy. I believe that Jane and Darcy will revitalise Austen scholarship, replacing long-held fictions with facts, and that her readers, particularly those in Australia, will be delighted to know her, after all these years, as Mrs. Darcy Wentworth, for the place in Australian history. Thank you.
So many thanks to Wal Walker. Janet Grundy's got copies of Jane and Darcy, Volume 1, Folly is Not Always Folly, and Volume 2, Such Talent and Such Success. So we come to questions and discussion, and we'll finish no later than the top of the hour. You've done a lot of work on this. You've come a long way since Gatton College. I think Gatton's best known as a site of a notorious Australian murder, I think.
That's right.
Yeah. But in relation to your allegation that Jane was a... Well, firstly, I'd like you to explain your relationship to Darcy, because I mucked that up at the start. But once you've done that, what would you pull out as the key bits of evidence to support your claim that Darcy... That she was a friend and lover of Darcy Wentworth? I mean, what would you say to the academic scholars and the family members who deny this? What would your key bits of evidence be? You come up here.
My response would be to read the two books. At first, when my Uncle Bill told me, I treated it rather dismissively and thought, well, you know, is it possible? But he had wanted to write it himself, because he'd asked Malcolm Ellis to write the story of Darcy. And Malcolm Ellis had made an attempt. He'd written one chapter and given up. It was too difficult, especially the time in English. People didn't. He couldn't understand what was going on. And secondly, the next person who tried was Ritchie, John Ritchie, and he couldn't fathom it out either. So that, you know, it's all fell a bit difficulty. They wouldn't start with the English story. They left that, you know, they're talking about being born in Ireland and then flicked quickly to the Australian, where it was all documented. But Darcy was himself was a very silent person. He never spoke or said anything to anybody. But there were people he knew. Amongst those that knew was Dr. John Harris. He'd attended Jane Austen when she was having the nervous breakdown, and was had been a friend of Darcy's for a year or so before that. And he was also a friend of MacArthur, so John MacArthur probably knew too. They at least were two people who knew fully. But And they knew not only of, you know, they knew of Jane Austen's relationship. They both, no, Harris knew her, but John MacArthur had never met her, as far as I know. But then, you know, they did a very good job, the Austens, in keeping the secret. And it's only when they released the Juvenilia, 100 years later, that you can see that there was so much truth in them that you couldn't deny it. And, you know, I mean, Margaret Throsby interviewed Stella Rillington in her hour and midday, and she asked her, she had written all these thrillers, and she said, where do you get the stories from? Oh, they're all stories from my life, you know. And when you know that people who write stories write their own lives into it. I mean, I've got one friend in Queensland who's written 4 detective novels, but she's a very famous gynecologist, and she's told her whole, you know, which is a very diverse and complicated life, it's all in the 5 detective novels and 4 detective novels she's written, that people can't resist. And Jane Austen wanted to bring these things to a family, and people say to me, oh, but she used all these other names of prominent people. She used, you know, they all came after she was, you know, the teenage period. She started using them as subterfuge and camouflage to deflect the family's anger a bit from the stories.
Okay. But they. All right, with that, and we'll just move on to some other. But just very briefly, the relationship from Darcy down to you is what? He was your...
He was my grandfather's great-grandfather, so there was 5 generations between us.
All right, so 5 generations. But just before, you mentioned your uncle. Now, that was Bill Wentworth, who was the politician in the 40s and 50s into the 60s, a minister briefly in the coalition governments in the mid-1960s, had a role in the 1967 referendum on Aborigines as the minister. So he was, I think you could say that he was an idiosyncratic but very clever man. I think that's probably fair enough. Right, so, yeah, so where do we go? Yeah, okay.
What, you were saying you had access to information. Where did you get this access from, besides from her books, where you say all the truth comes out of her stories? But, I mean, you said you were able to get access to information that hadn't been exposed before. Where did you get it from?
I got it from the newspapers, the English newspapers. Darcy's notoriety was written up on at least 20 times in the English newspapers, and although Jane Austen is not mentioned under the Jane Austen, she is there appearing in court, and she said, you know, the story to her father. I'll just tell you, her sister dobbed her in and said, look, and the father and when they heard that she'd been into court, she wrote this little story explaining. She said, I killed my father at a very early age, I killed my mother and now I'm about to kill my sister. And she said, but I've reformed now. But she tells this long story. She says, I forged my name for I perjured myself for 12 years in court, and forged my name on my own will and all the rest of these crazy things. And then at the end of this crazy letter, she says, but I'm going to kill my sister. Sister Cassandra dobbed her in. But there's a whole lot of little stories like this in the Juvenilia that, you know, tell us about what she was doing. She tells that she went to Newgate and all the rest of it. So it all fits in, and it's a time thing. It's Darcy's time in England coincides with all this writing that you know, this period of her life of this adolescent.
bit further. What worries me as a historian is that you speak about what Darcy and Jane were saying to each other. There are no footnotes. I can see that there are links, but when did they meet? I mean, what's the evidence they ever met? I mean, what specific occasion did they ever meet? Can you say that, or are you just... Is it, if Darcy wasn't there to start with, would you have said, oh, she met Darcy? I mean, if you hadn't had this story from your uncle, that there was something in the family, would you have ever thought that Darcy Wentworth met Jane Austen at any point from anything you read?
Well, I think it's quite well thought about by people in Australia. There were lots of people who thought that over a long period of time that Jane Austen and Darcy were connected somewhere, and people weren't sure how. People have said, "Oh, she read about him in the newspapers," but also people like Rudyard Kipling wrote a poem which I quoted at the end of the book there, and he said, "You know." He refers to her as Captain Wentworth because of the persuasion. See, it's such a painful novel. Persuasion, with so much feeling, it's telling such a painful story of this love and this and the persuasion that she'd suffered from the family and had to abandon this fellow. She doesn't tell it in a way that it's going to anger a family, but she tells it. But Darcy never came back. But, you know, Rudyard Kipling says, this was the person that Jane loved, Captain Wentworth.
Okay. There's a question down there. Yeah, just wait. Speak into the microphone, will you?
If one approaches it from the perspective of Darcy Wentworth rather than having regard to the secrecy of the Austen family, I'm just wondering, wouldn't the historical records, New South Wales historical records, show in some way whether or not Darcy Wentworth described himself as a married person or an unmarried person? Did you look into that?
Well, we know that all the convicts who came in the early ships all had to describe themselves not only by the ship that they came on, but whether they were married or not. And if they said they were married, then they were not permitted to marry again here. But he's recorded on Norfolk Island as married. And people like the Reverend Marsden never pushed him about it because it would be bigamy if he married again, you know, and that was a transportable offence.
That's my question. Is your theory supported by the historical records of New South Wales?
Only in that it's recorded there that he was a married person.
I see. Thank you.
So, are you in any contact with what's left of the family? I mean, how do you know all these people don't like you? I mean...
The Austens?
Oh, well, that, and the historians.
I will comment on this because I gave a presentation in readings in Melbourne, and one of the people who came along was a Jane Austen descendant, descendant of Charles, her younger brother. And she came with her friend, and the friend had marked the book right through. I said, "My God, you're not going to ask me questions about all those things." And she said, no. She introduced me to this. But after question time, she said, it was hypocritical that the Austens had denied for so long that there'd been any, you know, romance in Jane Austen's life. Her friend, you know, the Austen descendant, was, you know, in agreement with it. She didn't say, in as many words to me, but there, I'm just saying, there are Austins who believe it's absolutely stupid that, you know, they're still maintaining the story of that perpetual innocence.
But I guess in that generation it was quite common, was it not, that when people died, families would burn correspondence or destroy correspondence? That's not uncommon for those kind of middle-class or upper-middle-class families.
No. Well, Wickham, for instance, burnt all his personal files too. We don't see, we can't go to Wickham and look for Wentworth and Jane Austen there, you know. So there's a, you know, there's very few places where you can go to get a glimpse. People will know more than I know. I mean, I'm only putting a story out there where people are going to pick up and embellish it with more. I mean, I asked members of my family, the last generation of my family, Bill's, and on both the first generation of Darcy's, first family of Darcy's and the second family, and no, I couldn't get very much. I couldn't get acceptance of that it was a possibility, but they had nothing to confirm it.
Well, tell us a bit about your uncle. I used to see him occasionally outside the Union Club up here, but he lived to a very advanced age, and I knew him a little bit, but you obviously knew him very well. So what was his... I mean, he had a lot of interest in a lot of very diverse things, from railway tracks to all sorts of things. He was a very interesting man, but what's your memory of him, and why do you think he focused on this story?
Well, he would have liked to have written it, but he didn't have access to the internet. And for the internet, I found all these 20 mentions in all these British papers of Darcy's life, and details of the court hearings and all the rest of it. And I found that he'd been qualified twice as a surgeon. You know, they once to, as a for to go to the East India Company, and the second time to be a a naval surgeon. But he's twice qualified through the college. It was called the College of Surgeons, but it's now a sort of more grander title. But it's through the newspapers and things that I could find, you know, traces of his life.
Well, what about your uncle? What was
it? Well, my uncle, I'll answer.
No, just answer that, then we'll go here. Yeah.
I'll answer for Victoria too, perhaps. He was like a father to me in many ways. I was at school at Tudor House with his children, and then at Armidale School with two of his three sons. So I knew him very well. He used to be... I used to see him a couple of times each year, sort of thing. But in the end, he went to live up in Caranda, and he found he couldn't manage, you know. He was always part of the Sydney thing and coming back and forth all the time. And we looked after him in Sydney for a while, and then also he went into Lady Gowry home at Gordon, and we used to take him out every weekend, you know, and take him out to do works inspection of the railway tracks and whatever, and timing the roads, you know, that had been upgraded and made into highways and what have you. And Victoria got very involved with him in Canberra. She was working in Canberra. I was busy flat out here in Sydney. And she looked after him through all the Aboriginal stuff. And she was far more au fait with Bill and his involvement in Aboriginal things than any of his family or anybody else. So she met all these people, Dodson and all these people who worked in ASIC and all these things. And so, you know, this is really how our contact was, you know, established in this later.
Just got the microphone coming up here. Just speak into it.
I'll just ask a question that I think might answer Gerard's. Why do you think Bill thought
it was timely to tell the story. It had never been told. The family was so busy in their public life. Why do you think, when he asked you to do it, whatever it is, 15 years ago, why did he think it was time?
Well, simply that he probably realised that he had very little time to live. He couldn't use the internet, although it was by then going. We tried to get him interested, but he was not very interested to try. And he realised that somebody needed to do it. He saw that I was the person who would be willing to do the hard yards, and I was at that point of retiring in my life. And I retired like in 6 years later after these requests. And then I had time to do it.
So we're getting close to the end. Up there, Robert. Yeah?
Does anything survive of the work done by the other historians, M.H. Ellis and John Ritchie? Did they leave research or papers or any other evidence of the work that they did?
Yes. And the work of Ritchie was actually a student did the work, a girl called Dermody, I've forgotten her name, Kathleen Dermody, and she did a lot of work, and that was a good essay, and a fellow called Barker submitted an essay for a master's degree at the University of New England. They were both used. Ellis, who did the work first, who Bill thought would be the man to do the job, got so involved in writing about the MacArthurs, he got sort of seduced by Sir Denzel MacArthur Onslow, and he became very much involved with them. But he gave up, I think, because of he couldn't fathom out what was going on in England. It was just so complicated.
So just finally, it must have taken you a long time to write this. Are you planning anything else along these lines, or what's the future of Jane and Darcy?
Well, I don't know. The Austin Society is very, very strongly barricaded in. They don't want to consider any new material that might come up at all. And so they're not very open. So how we're not getting any penetration at all in North America or in England, a little bit of penetration here, but not through the Jane Austen Society. I asked initially, submitted it to Giles Delamere, who was the one of the directors of Faber and Faber, and then later published in his own name. And I gave it to him to read in draft, and he said he believed it absolutely. So, but he said to me, it's an Australian story. He wasn't going to publish it in England. He knew how difficultly it would be to upset the perceived perceptions. You know, he wasn't going to try. And he said, look, it's an Australian story. Run it, get somebody to publish it in Australia. Well, the Australian publishers just saw it as too speculative and ran away from it. They just thought, oh, this couldn't possibly be true.
So you end up at the Sydney Institute.
Can I just get you to explain one thing?
There's a final
passing. With the doctor connected with MacArthur knew about her breakdown. Could you explain a bit more about that? Because it's a huge story. I mean, if there's any evidence.
Well, I spoke to John Harris, he's not a direct descendant. John Harris had no children. He didn't know anything about it. But in one of the stories, in the Juvenilia, I said to him, did you know that Jane Austen, you know, wrote about you? And I said, and he also sent him up. John Harris was born in Ireland at a place called Moy Mucklemurray, and Jane Austen refers to it as Crankham Dunbury, and kill blueberry in her juvenilia.
But you know that that's about John Harris.
Yeah, she doesn't call him John Harris.
That's the trouble.
In Sense and Sensibility.
In Sense and Sensibility, he's called Dr. Harris, but in that short story, he's not called Dr.
And just finally, just tell us a little bit about Darcy. I mean, you say he's Irish, so he's obviously Anglo-Irish.
Yes.
So he comes to Australia, so he dies when?
He died 10 years after Jane Austen in 1827, in July.
Okay.
He died on the 7th of July, I think, 1827.
Okay. All right, thanks for that. Now, Janet Grundy's got copies of Volume 1 and Volume 2 of Jane and Darcy. Well, I don't have... Not on my clock, it isn't. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Did Darcy leave any diaries or letters or any written anything in his life, from his life?
Well, there is lots and lots of stuff in the library, in the Mitchell Library. His life is quite well documented because lots of the early letters and things are there, and that give us a much greater insight into his life. But the people who have written so far haven't picked these up. And the same with William Charles. I've written a lot about William Charles in this book in the last chapter that has never been picked up before. Part of it is because it's very difficult to read these writings with quill pens that have been put onto microfiche, and the library have been very, very reluctant to let me see the originals because they feel they're too precious or something. And they... notwithstanding that my great-grandfather gave them to the library.
So unfair.
Okay, so as I was saying, Dan Grundy's got copies of Volume 1 and Volume 2, and thanks for a very lively presentation and for raising some mystery about Jane Austen and Darcy Wentworth. So, well done. I hope the book launch goes well, but for tonight, thank you and... good luck.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.